Imagine enjoying your creative writing English class so much that you pursue a career in writing. Jeff Blair, Stephen Brunt. They're either super talented or somewhat insane. Maybe both. This is Writer's Block on Sportsnet 590 The Fan.
Well, here I was all set, Stephen Brunt, to exciting night of viewing on the network. I was watching the Jays and the Red Sox, flip over to see what the Seattle Kraken are going to look like, and I now know what they're going to look like.
No suspense.
No suspense. No Carey Price. I mean, unless they have pulled off the smokescreen of all smokescreens, no Carey Price. You know, the Jared McCann is going to Seattle. It's interesting. Some of the moves that the Kraken have made, allegedly made, the free agent signings. It's obvious that they are. It's obvious that even as an expansion team, they're interested in value. I mean, the idea that they're just going to go out and add everybody and then add the numbers together and see where they are and then fill after that, I don't think that's the case. They've taken a very, and no surprise, because God knows they've had enough lead-in time here. They've taken a very studied approach to what they're doing. And I guess it, you know, given the fact that they're turning this into a kind of a TV production, and it really, I don't think it's really necessarily for the hockey media. It's probably not a big surprise that names have gotten out there because they want to put on a show. They want to do it right. They want to make a splash. And in order to do that, you've got to let players know ahead of time. So it's not a surprise, I don't think.
Yeah, I guess that's true, isn't it? I was thinking, boy, that you know, if you were producing this for television, you want to keep the drama going to the absolute last second, but you also want those players available to you. So
yeah.
The word is there are too many people. The circle of knowledge here, the circle of trust is going to get pretty large when you start adding in players and agents and friends and family members and God knows who else might know, and general managers and coaches, right? So there's a whole lot of folks who know, and there are a whole lot of folks whose job it is to glean information from the hockey universe. So once that starts happening, this is inevitable. So yeah, may not be quite as dramatic, but there won't be any suspense, but it'll be fun to watch them see what they're going to put on a show.
Oh, it'll be a great show.
It'll be kind of cool to see what they do. Yeah.
By the way, the Tampa Bay Rays have just walked off the Baltimore Orioles. And there you go. So for what that's worth, the game is on right now. The Jays will play the Red Sox tonight, their final game. Hey, Austin Meadows did it, so he doesn't just hit against the Blue Jays. The Jays will play their final game in Buffalo tonight at Salem Field against the Red Sox, 7:07 first pitch. Yesterday's game was postponed, and I honest to God, Brent, I think Ross and Mark were up on the roof, and they were spraying water. They were forcing the grounds crew to water it down. Get that extra game. First of all, avoid having to play the Red Sox right now. Secondly, get that extra game in Toronto. And it'll be made up as part
split
of a doubleheader.
Yeah, and a split doubleheader. So 15,000 seats, and you know what? Normally a fan, you might begrudge them that and say, why didn't they just play a straight up?
No, I would have done the same damn thing.
One ticket. Oh, they haven't sold tickets in a year. Like it's I'd do the same thing too.
We'll be joined, by the way, by Shai Davidi of Sportsnet at 3:20. The Jays made a minor transaction today. Joel Piamps has been traded. He was DFA'd. He was traded for a little bit of money to the Kansas City Royals, who will be the Jays' opposition on the 30th when they come back here. So Shai will join us, and we'll take a look at Ross Atkins' comments yesterday ahead of the trade deadline. And Ross Atkins, by the way, will be on Tim and Friends tonight at 5:20. Shout out to our friend Tim McAuliffe, one of many, 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 many award winners. Is it Canadian Screen Awards? Is that the official title?
That is it. And yeah. And Timmy was named best sports host. It was the sports version of it because they had the other Canadian Screen Awards were in March, I think. But because there was not a lot of sports in that chunk of the calendar year, they extended it, and so it was a sports only virtual award ceremony last night. And yeah, hats off to our pal Tim and some of our other colleagues who did real well last night.
There was a ton of winners there. So well done to everybody. So again, Ross Atkins will be on Tim and Friends tonight around 5:20. Ren Lavoir, NHL insider at Tavia Sports, joins us at 4 o'clock, 4:25. David Sampson will be along. I'll see if David's got any insight into what's going on with the Oakland Athletics. It sure seems as if, you understand how these things work in baseball, but it certainly seems as if the Athletics and the commissioner are kind of ramping up the pressure in the city of Oakland. So we'll see what David has to say about that. I mentioned Diana Matheson, 2-time bronze medalist with Canada in 2012 and 2016, and soccer analyst at CBC. She will join us. She, of course, had the bronze medal winning goal in London, or I guess actually it was in Coventry, where she scored the goal. But Stephen Brunt, this morning, those of us who got up early enough to see the Canadian women take on Japan, a 1-1 draw with Japan that it was not the preferred outcome, to say the least. I think in Canada's group, you want 3 points against Japan, 3 points against Chile, and then take what you can get against Great Britain. But Canada had one shot and goal. It was a goal. Guess who scored it? Christine Simpson.
Yeah. She did. Sinclair. Yeah.
All right, sorry, Christine. Well, Christine Simpson could have too. Christine Sinclair scored scored the goal, and Canada let in the equalizer after Steph LeBay, their goalkeeper, had to leave with the shoulder injury. It wasn't a tough loss, but it was certainly a tough tie for the Canadian team. I don't know if you had a chance to see it.
Yeah, I did. It's not quite as early here in Newfoundland, of course, so I got an hour and a half to jump on you guys. I got an hour and a half more sleep before that match kicked off. So yeah, I did watch it this morning, and I haven't gone as completely into the brackets here and how the crossover works as this tournament progresses. Obviously, first two in every group go through, plus I think two best third place finishers. Mm-hmm. So it's not like this endangered Canada's chances of advancing to the next round of the quarterfinals. They almost certainly will, if they beat Chile, which is expected. But yeah, it was not like they were the better side this morning. They got kind of nervous up front. Inability to finish. Japan had one scoring, other than the penalty, which was saved by LeBay, and a really pretty much a god awful penalty attempt by the Japanese player. She kind of froze too. But beyond that, Japan had one chance from open play and they scored on it. Mm-hmm. That's it.
That was a pretty Canada, goal too.
It was a beautiful goal, yeah. So full marks for that. But Japan were kind of confused at the back, and their keeper looked really shaky. And it looked like if Canada had just put a few more shots on her, they would have scored. There was a lot of confusion there, and they couldn't quite get over the hump. It was a weird, we all know by now what games in empty stadiums look and sound like, but I guess it's the first taste of what the empty stadium Olympics are going to look like.
That was, really empty. It seemed empty. Maybe it's because of the size of the place, but there was no soundstage quality to that we saw at some of the other places. None at all.
No. And no kind of enhanced sound from the pitch or anything like that. It just felt like it was being played in a big empty aircraft hangar or something. And, that's part of it. It didn't feel like the Olympics. Of course, Japan as the home team would have had a huge crowd pulling for them normally. They would have also had the pressure of playing on home soil, which can be tricky. So there wasn't, it felt like there was no kind of an emotional dynamic to the match at all. And, we'll see. I think there's obviously a ton of talent on this Canadian side. And there was some other stuff happening. Like the Americans got smoked by Sweden today.
3-0, yeah.
So... this is going to be a different kind of tournament. And I certainly do not discount this Canadian team's ability to, especially pull together, especially during the Olympics. Unsatisfying. I don't think anybody, I'm sure they didn't feel great about that performance today.
No, you could tell just by the body language and seeing Christine Sinclair in particular at the end of the match. I mean, those women, I mean, there's her, there's Desiree Scott, there's a lot of women. There are a lot of women in that team who've been through this before, and they're well aware of what needs to get done and what result is necessary. Now they play Chile, and if they beat Chile, they should still be, I think, and I don't want to get into the whole permutations and calculations, but my understanding is they should be okay. It would certainly help if they would beat Great Britain as well. But so that is, the Olympics have started. Canada's women's softball team also won, and the opening ceremonies are Friday. So we will keep you informed as to all the goings on leading up to the ceremonies, and we hope, we assume that the Olympics are going to come off. It was weird hearing the WHO today kind of come out and say that it's a good thing. That was a little odd.
Yeah, and kind of an
it's,
yeah,
a good thing, but we still, the pandemic's not over, but it's good that we're all getting together in Tokyo. It was just strange. It was a strange presentation, shall we say.
Well, considering these are essentially the folks who have been the harbingers of doom now for, what, 2 years, right? Yeah. And to have the head of the WHO get up there and say, you know, be kind of nice if everybody could get together and the Olympics would make people feel good and bring us together. And I thought, man, aren't you the guys who cut through all of that and say, no, but the science is otherwise? It was as sentimental as I've ever heard the World Health Organization. And, you know, look, maybe they have a point to a degree that it would be maybe good for the world if this comes off and we can all just kind of indulge in cheering for our home sides and our home countries and indulge in all of that good Olympic stuff for a couple of weeks. But yeah, it's given that came, what, the day after the head of the LOC, the local organizing committee, said, we might still cancel this. We talked about this a bit yesterday, Jeff, like the days leading up to an Olympics are always a bit fraught, no matter where you are. But this one, I don't think we've ever had the head of the LOC, you know, 72 hours before the cauldron's going to get lit, saying, hey, we might cancel this. So we shall see. I assume it's going to continue and it's going to come off. But I'm not sure we're ever going to be able to settle into it like a warm bath. I don't think that's in the cards this year.
We should talk a little bit about the Milwaukee Bucks as well. NBA champion Milwaukee Bucks. Surprising to me, considering I thought I had no faith at all in Mike Budenholzer, their head coach. But I would say probably it's weird as a neutral. I kind of wanted Phoenix to win just because I love the story. I like Chris Paul. But you know what? The more I heard, I should maybe guard against this, but the more I heard of Giannis Antetokounmpo, the more I really, really wanted to see him in Milwaukee win that. And I think in the past, there have been a couple of interviews with Giannis in the past 3 days that have been they've been remarkable, Stephen, for the depth of their simplicity. I can't put it any other way. You know, the answers he had to questions that he could have, you know, shrugged off with cliches, he answered just extremely well. You know what he did? He kind of wrote he wrote the story of Giannis for me. I guess that's how I would put it.
That's a great way of putting it. You know that? We were talking yesterday in a different context about, how you want athletes to, you know, it's great when they're honest, right? When they don't speak in cliches, even though sometimes they get blowback for doing it. We were talking about the Ross Stripling, which is completely different. But I think this is what this has done is, everybody is kind of focused on, and again, there are a lot of guys who had a hand in that championship, but the focus belongs, deservedly on a guy who, has been regarded as one of the three or four best players in the world, has been regarded as a, quote, freak, unquote, a physical freak, a guy who can do stuff at his size that very few people can. But I think this was, it's kind of, it's weird to say kind of a coming out party for a guy who's already a superstar, but it was.
Yeah.
I think people appreciated him in a way. And, you know, it's also, you know, let's not forget that, you know, however many days it was ago, that it looked like he'd blown his knee to smithereens.
Mm-hmm.
So it looked like he was not going to play this in these playoffs. So he comes back from that. You know, they come back from 0-2, and he dominates a series in a way that, you know, like, what's the comparable is LeBron. You know, different player, but the comparable is LeBron, right? LeBron with a decent supporting cast. That's what it felt like. And, you know, when next basketball season begins, that's going to be kind of the starting point, is can anybody in the East beat Giannis? You know, and if they have a good regular season, we're not going to be saying, well, it's a mirage because they can't do it in the playoffs. Look at what happened to them in the past. They were up 2-0 in the Raptors championship season. They imploded in the bubble. Well, guess what? You know, they were down 0-2 in the final and roared back and destroyed Phoenix, really. You know, like, they were competitive games, but they were the better team. And he is ascendant right now.
Yeah.
And and I think you're right about the way, you know, he's obviously a fascinating guy because of his background. He's completely fascinating. But this was his show.
Mm-hmm.
And that's, you know, one of the things I was thinking, Jeff, is, you know, if you're the Toronto Raptors or you're the Brooklyn Nets or you're in, or the Knicks or Miami or anybody else who aspires to win in the Eastern Conference, the NBA, you now have to get by these guys.
Well,
once you've done it, that changes, doesn't it?
Well, and I will say this, and I wish I could remember who made this point, but watching Giannis in this series and thinking back to how the Toronto Raptors appeared to throw everything they had at a gamble that they would get him in free agency, I will say this, it didn't work out, but I understand it better now. I understand that gamble better now. I that's probably not going to bring, you know, that may not bring satisfaction to Raptors fans, but I get it now. And the thing I was thinking about this morning, it was a wholly satisfactory outcome. I just think it was a good outcome. It felt good. And we don't always get that in professional sports or any sports where you sit back and you go, on balance, that's kind of cool.
Well, and also, you know, you kind of root for towns like Milwaukee every once in a while.
Sure.
Like, I don't know about you, but I sure do. Maybe it's my Hamilton thing, but coming from a place like Hamilton, which just the little place next to a big place, right? Milwaukee's always the little place up the road from Chicago, you know, and the place that, you know, had Kareem and then didn't have Kareem, you know, basketball wise, right? That's their whole history. They had him. They won a championship. He went to the Lakers, and they've never been there since. So, it's great for them to be, you know, for that town to be on top of the world. It's great that, you know, it's kind of great that it would have been awesome if he had been a Raptor, but it is kind of great that he went back there, that he decided to stay and he delivered. And, you know, and I don't anticipate, maybe I'm wrong, but I don't anticipate him, you know, a year from now or 2 years from now saying, you know, I want out of here because I want to assemble with, you know, two other guys in Miami and build a super team.
No, I thought he was.
Doesn't seem like that's what he is.
No, I thought it was pretty clear. He was pretty clear in his description of super teams and kind of why he did what he did. He has become the first player in NBA history to average 30 points, 10 boards, and 5 assists while shooting 60% in an NBA Finals series. He is the first player in NBA history to average 30 points, 10 boards, and 5 assists on 50% shooting in the playoffs. As well, a remarkable postseason performance by Giannis Antetokounmpo. The Blue Jays will take on the Boston Red Sox tonight, the final game at Salem Field. 7:07 first pitch on Sportsnet 590, The Fan and Sportsnet. And folks, after tonight, that's it for Buffalo. 9 days and counting, the Blue Jays will be back at the Rogers Center. Shai Davidi is Sportsnet's MLB insider. He'll join us next. This is Writer's Block on Sportsnet 590, The Fan. .707 will be the first pitch tonight from Salem Field in Buffalo as the Jays and the Boston Red Sox wrap up their series. yesterday's game was rained out in Buffalo. It will be made up as part of a doubleheader in Toronto, much to the delight of everybody who wasn't a Boston Red Sox fan and had gone to Buffalo. Let's bring in Shai Davidi, our MLB insider with Sportsnet. So, Shai, what do you think? It took like 10 seconds to make that call. Was that the easiest rainout call in the history of baseball?
Yeah, I mean, pretty much, right? Who doesn't, or if you're the Blue Jays or any team, who wouldn't want to take a rainout and get it back to your real home instead of your alternate home when you know that fans of the other team have descended upon your makeshift home to cheer for your opponent that night? So, yeah, definitely a no-brainer. And, you know, I think this is, like, I'm trying to think how many doubleheaders there have been at the Dome. Like, the last one I remember was when there was the ice chunk fell off the CN Tower, punctured a hole in the roof.
Right.
When was that, 17 or 16?
Well, I don't know if this was a doubleheader. I know you were there. Did they have a doubleheader when the home opener against Kansas City was canceled because a couple of panels fell off the roof? And I don't know if they had a doubleheader as a result of that or if they just played on an off day. I guess I could look easily enough.
But I think that's the one. That's the same one where it was tied to the ice chunks that fell off the CN Tower and punctured a hole in the roof. And yeah, I'm not sure if that was a home opener or not. I think it was in mid-April, and I think that's the last time there was a doubleheader at the Dome, unless my memory is failing me. And there had been a long, long time before that. So pretty neat, you know, especially think the Blue Jays are just coming back back home, and you know, they managed to sneak in another home date there now.
Hey, Shai, before we look ahead to the deadline and talk about the other stuff today, there was some roster moves yesterday. One of them, the Jays DFA, TJ Zoik. So he will be traded or he will be put through waivers at some point. But, you know, first round picks. But what do you think, you know, a little bit of a surprise, I thought, that they DFA'd him just because of where he was selected. And, you know, not enough swing and miss, obviously, but, you know, why didn't TJ Zoik, who, you know, normally you would think a guy picked in that position is pretty close, you know, is going to be a guy. What was it that prevented him from doing that, at least with the Jays?
Well, I think there's a couple things going on there in terms of, you know, why him, right? I think that just speaks to sort of where the 40-man roster is at. And, you know, these decisions are getting a little bit harder for the Blue Jays right now, and they're going to have a bunch more because, you know, they've got a few other guys on the 60-man roster who are going to force decisions upon them too. So, you know, I think that's one piece of it. But I think the primary one, you know, the Blue Jays have had a few looks at him. You know, the swing and miss just isn't there. The secondary pitches aren't there. You know, basically, if he's not getting ground balls and he doesn't have that sinker really working, then, you know, there are a lot of balls that are in really hittable parts of the strike zone. So, you know, I think the Blue Jays had seen some signs where they thought, okay, maybe this might be better than we think, and he's turning the corner. There was certainly that stretch at the end towards the middle or end of spring training where he started taking a jump with his velocity. He had that good start in the opening series in New York against the Yankees. But there just hasn't been that same consistency and level of success since. And I think that's part of the factor, or that's a factor here in why he ended up one of the odd men out.
Shai, you know, the interesting takeaway from yesterday's availability with Ross Atkins, and he will be on Tim and Friends, by the way, at 5:20 as well today, was his comments on Nate Pearson, who has a sports hernia, or had a sports hernia, however you would describe it, but he is going to start working his way back. The plans are, right now, at least, if all goes according to Hoyle, he will join the Blue Jays, help them out of the bullpen. I don't have a timeline for that, but and then come back. Hopefully, knock on wood, come back next year, and take a run at a rotation spot. From what you are hearing, are the Jays comfortable enough with the notion of Nate Pearson contributing that it would have a tangible impact on their approach at the trade deadline, or are they still going to look for a little more swing and miss out of the bullpen, you know, in addition to perhaps a starting pitcher and other things that would factor into Ross's run prevention focus.
Yeah, I don't think this takes them out of that market, but it may change a little bit in terms of how they're shopping, right? Where, you know, if you were convinced that you weren't going to have Nate Pearson, that he wasn't going to be a factor at all, and you're convinced that, you know, Julian Merriweather isn't coming back at any point, and, you know, at that point, you're like, okay, well, we really got to bolster this and we need to rebuild some depth. But, you know, I think knowing that they're going to be, or at least Nate Pearson at this point, is on track to be a factor relatively soon, you know, does that maybe mitigate some of your needs there? Maybe a little bit, right? And at that point, you're like, well, if we're going to spend this amount of prospect capital, maybe we allocate that to a different area, and maybe we get one arm for the bullpen instead of two or something along those lines. Now, you know, the one thing that, you know, the Blue Jays will have a better read on than anybody else, you know, what physically is he going to be capable of, right? You know, that sports hernia isn't going away. It's something they're going to have to manage and then deal with in the off season. So can you trust that he's going to be able to be in your bullpen consistently and be available on a regular enough basis for a team that's in contention? You know, that's the question the Blue Jays have to answer in their minds a little bit in the next week and a half before the deadline hits. And you know, I think right now we're all guessing on that regard. You know, they've got the medical records. They know the full answer. But you know, I think we'll see. But if they have confidence that he's going to be able to be reliable for them, and that's really been one question mark that's followed him to this point in his career. You know, can he be reliable enough that you can trust him, his ability to stay on the field? You know, I would think it absolutely changes their plans a little bit, at least.
You know, this, and again, this may not be entirely, well, I just want to be fair to Nate on this one, but, you know, I reading between the lines on that, Shai, I thought they took them, what, 4 medical opinions to get that diagnosis? And, you know, the previous diagnosis was a groin pull, which is, a you know, not a sports hernia, but not that different than a sports hernia. I wonder if this was about giving Nate Pearson an answer and giving him something he could work through, because, as you say, this is not going to get fixed until the off season. He presumably feels pretty much the same as he's felt for quite some time. But, you know, I wonder if part of the idea is here, if he has an answer that he and his team are satisfied with, that he'll be more comfortable going out there and pitching through perhaps a little bit of discomfort, you know, in for the rest of the season, and, you know, ideally for them into the postseason. It's, you know, it's not the same as the Aaron Sanchez situation, but sometimes I think as pitchers especially, you know, if they don't feel 100%, they need an answer about what that 99, that 1 percentile of discomfort is.
Oh, 100% on that. Yeah, and it's a great point, because, look, you have to trust your body, you know, especially with what Nate Pearson does. You know, if you're throwing 100 miles an hour, you're using every bit of your body to generate the force necessary for that. And you have to trust that you're not doing anything worse. Now, you know, I'm far from a doctor, but, you know, just, I remember, I think it was 2011, maybe, that ended after the season was done, we found out that Jose Bautista had a sports hernia, and he had played through that for an extended period. And I remember talking to someone at the time, they said, look, sports hernias are really, really tricky to diagnose because they can present in a number of different ways. And I wonder if that's part of this too, where, you know, this was just something that they were having trouble diagnosing for an extended period, and that created that doubt for Nate Pearson as well, understandably so, because, you know, you keep on experiencing the same issues and you can't resolve them, and it's because you're just not finding it, because it's a little bit of a tricky thing. So I think all that factors into it, but, you know, I do think the fact that he does have some clarity, you know, Ross Atkins used the word huge, huge relief to describe them finally getting an answer. And you know, it's pretty clear that, you know, they were all looking for something like that, because this has been something that's dragged on for, what are we talking, 3 months now at this point? you know, I mean, that's a long time to go with a lot of question marks.
You know, a guy we haven't talked about, and his name came up yesterday, and someone who I think, you know, I think Jays fans essentially forget they have this guy on the roster. But what are the Jays' plans for Corey Dickerson? Because I understand that there's going to be a lot of talk around the deadline about getting this guy and then getting that guy. But shy to me, Corey Dickerson could be a I wouldn't say a difference maker for this team, but man, he gives them something they haven't had.
Yeah, I mean, it's a really nice piece, right? I mean, if he's healthy and he's productive, you know, the power from the left side, and a guy who has been in the past, you know, a plus defender. You know, we'll see physically what he's capable of recovering from the injury, and, you know, if there are any lingering after effects from that. But, you know, if he can be, you know, even a slightly above average defender, and, you know, can regain some of that power stroke. Look, he doesn't have to be an impact guy on a daily basis. But when you get, like, those really, really tough right-handed pitchers, you know, like the Garrett Coles of the world, you know, to have a left-handed bat to break up, you know, the slew of right-handed bats, you know, keep those right-handed pitchers from getting into that rhythm, being able to sort of lock in, you know, fastball slider location, say, and just repeat it over and over against the group of right-handed hitters. You know, that's important, right? To throw a little bit of a wrench in there against those types of difficult right-handers. So, you know, he's definitely got a chance to play a fairly significant role. Again, they don't need him to be a superstar. If he can just, you know, come in, you know, and provide that nice little bit of contribution on a periodic basis, then you've got something, and, you know, it becomes one less thing that they need to look for at the trade deadline.
Shai, good stuff, man. Thank you so much for joining us today.
No problem. Take care, guys.
Shai Davidi, our MLB insider with Sportsnet. 7:07, first pitch from Salem Field tonight. As the Jays and the Boston Red Sox will wrap up their series, and it's on to play the Mets. And I believe Marcus Stroman is starting tonight for the Mets. So that would mean that in addition.
We're going to miss him?
Well, let me just check here. Let me just check. Because he pitched today. So they're not seeing Jacob DeGrom. DeGrom's on the IL. So let's go Thursday, Friday. Yeah, they would miss him.
Man, that's too bad. I was looking forward to that.
Yeah, I kind of was too. I kind of was too.
Oh, yeah.
But no DeGrom, no Stroman. So things are kind of breaking the Jays' way. Japan and Canada played to a 1-1 draw this morning in the first match of the Women's Olympic Soccer competition in Japan. Canada took the lead in the six-minute mark from Christine Sinclair. Japan tied it up. Lots of activity by the Canadian team. They were far and away the best team. They had most possession. There was a lot of pace up and down the flank. They did everything right. The only thing they didn't do is finish. In point of fact, other than Christine Sinclair's one goal, they had no shots on goal for all their domination. And not a death blow to the chances of the Canadian team, but let's put it this way. I guarantee you, as Bev Priestman and the leadership core of that team sat down going into the Olympics, in their mind, they scribbled down 3 points coming out of that match. Diana Matheson is a two-time bronze medalist with the Canadian women's team. She had the bronze medal winning goal in 2012 against France. She's also part of CBC's coverage of the Japan Olympics. She's one of their soccer analysts. And Diana Matheson will join us next. This is Writer's Block. This is Sportsnet 590, The Fan. Ceremonies are on Friday, but the Olympics have begun. The Canadian women's softball team picking up a win over Mexico. And the Canadian women's soccer team starting their competition this morning. around 6:30, I guess, Eastern time. And despite having the vast majority of the play, the Canadian women managed one shot on goal in a 1-1 draw with Japan. They also lost goalkeeper Steph LeBay with what we are led to believe is a shoulder injury. Canada's goal was scored by Christine Sinclair, which is, of course, no surprise if you follow the Canadian women. But I think it also, at the end of the day, the fact that Christine managed to score on the only shot Canada had, despite, as I said, having the ball most of the time, despite some really good runs up and down the pitch, that fact is probably it's probably something that Bev Priestman and her staff will have spoken to the Canadians about. Diana Matheson is a two-time bronze medalist with Canada. She, of course, had the bronze medal winning goal against the French in 2012, and she joins us on Writer's Block. Diana, thank you so much for joining us today. Look, you know a lot of the personalities on that team very well. What would have been said in the locker room after that match?
Well, thanks for having me. That was quite the dour description, guys. Did you watch the game?
Yeah, I thought.
Yep.
Yes, we did. I thought they played pretty well, but yeah. You know, I mean, the finish. Again, I thought there was a lack of finish, and I thought there were a couple of times where you know, where the reliance in Christine, I would have preferred seeing somebody be a little more, I guess, a little brave. I know that's a soccer word.
Yeah.
I would have liked to seen a little more bravery from a couple of the players. That's how I would put it, because I think they're far and away the better team than Japan.
Yeah, they were. And I think they're going to be gutted they didn't get the 3 points for sure, but tournament play, they'll get over it pretty quick. You guys watched. They certainly created enough around the goal to score more. We just weren't shooting enough, were we? We weren't lethal enough. And we were passing a few many times in the 18, where definitely players like Nichelle, Prince, Ash had a good chance at the end. They just got to start ripping them, and I think someone will go in the back of the net. I think the first games of the Olympics or World Cups are always the most nervy. So given that, we started pretty strongly. I'd say. And the other thing, too, is you really want to grow through a tournament, we like to say. So lots of room to grow there. For me, you know what? All they got to do is go watch some Melissa Tancredi game tape of her making runs into the box and shooting the ball, and then we should be good to go for the next match.
Yeah, that's a great the image of Tank going through. They could have used someone like that today. Absolutely, Diana. What, you know, you talked about how you kind of, you know, getting settling into a tournament. The first game is always a bit nervy, no matter what the circumstances. I find it hard to imagine what those circumstances are like this time around. You know, Jeff and I were talking about this earlier in the show, watching that match in that big, echoey, empty stadium. You know, yeah. I'm sure, you know, you know what it's like. You know what it's like to be in an Olympic village and be at an Olympic city. And this, it's got to be nothing like that this time around. Do you have any sense, you know, from anybody on the side what it's been like for them?
Yeah, it sounded pretty different for sure, from both the players and from some of the media over there. There's definitely not the fanfare and the, you know, the buzz around Tokyo, which there usually is. There's not Olympic rings scattering the whole city, which I think is fair. You know, a lot of the people don't want the Olympics over there. I think the team started feeling the excitement once they got to see the stadium. They're in Sapporo, so they're not right in Tokyo, and the stadium there is pretty amazing. It's covered in all the Olympic rings and everything. So I think it started to feel really real when they saw that. And when they got their Olympic gear, that's always a fun moment too. But you're right. It has a totally different feel about it, kind of externally. But certainly the pressures are the same, and they still know what they're playing for over there.
You made an interesting point earlier about tournament play. And there really is, something different, and there's an art, isn't there, about tournament play. You know, John Herdman used to talk about it. There is, you said, kind of a gradual buildup. As a player, how do you keep that? You know, I'm sure you live for the moment, But how do you also balance out living for the moment with an understanding that, okay, there really is a process to a tournament? It's not simply win this game, win this game, win this game, win this game. It's not always going to happen like that. There's a process to it.
Yeah, I guess and you're never trying to start off average so you can grow, are you? But it does tend to happen that way, certainly, where the teams that start a bit slow and improve are the teams that win. I mean, certainly in London, we came third in our group. And really, it was our third group game against Sweden where we hit another level and then never looked back. And then you hit momentum going into the knockouts is exactly the time you want to get some momentum. That's when it really matters. And then Rio was a bit different. We won our group, but then found ourselves on a harder path, had to play the Germans twice, and we're out. There's definitely something mentally, I think, around every game you just feel like you're getting better. And then at some point in a tournament, you just feel a bit invincible. And that's when things really just start to go your way. Because the turnaround in the Olympics is so short. Like, it's only 2 days off in between games, which is not enough for soccer players. So you don't get to really recover physically. And you got time to look back at your game and say, here's the one or two things we're going to take from that game and improve it next game. So move on. So you really just improve every game from that.
I was going to ask you, Diana, you maybe just partially answered the question, but, you know, this, aside from the size of the field, how is the Olympic tournament different from the World Cup from a player's point of view? Obviously, Canada, we've had great success in this particular tournament, but what are the big points of differentiation between this and a World Cup?
The multi-games feel of it is always very different, although in some ways we're sheltered from that because we're never in Tokyo, we're never in the host city, so we still end up in a hotel somewhere with a stadium. But you know you're part of a larger team, and that matters, and you know more Canadians are watching, and you're really playing for the Maple Leafs. That's part of it. And then the other one is what you just said. It's a smaller roster than the World Cup, 18 versus 23, with less rest and recovery in between. So it's like run and gun, and you're exhausted at the end of the 16 days.
How will Bev and the Canadian team handle any potential absence of Steph LeBay?
Well, we're fortunate, aren't we, that we always seem to have like two or three world-class Canadian keepers. I think people were debating going into this Olympics who's going to start because Kaylin's been incredible in her professional club for years now. And really, either one of them can do the job. I think Steph played the first game because she had the experience in what can be a very nervy game. So I think Kaylin coming in isn't too much of a worry for Canada. I think she'll be incredible. And hopefully we see Steph back also, so she's an option.
You know, it was amazing, Diana, watching. You know, obviously Sink scored that early goal today, but there are all kinds of little moments from her, those little moments of brilliance that you see if you watch her play. At this stage, you know, I presumably a late stage of her career, you know, although she may just go on forever, but how is the Christine Sinclair we see today different than, you know, than we would have seen, you know, 5-7 years ago?
She definitely plays differently now than she used to. Certainly she drops down a bit lower, more as a false nine. She's done that with her club for a while in Portland, and now she's doing with Canada. I mean, she's 38 now, right? Like, that's crazy that she's been able to do this for all these years. So physically, I mean, she's not the player she was in London or 10 years from that. I mean, she used to just blaze teams in behind. Like, she could run out. She could outrun anyone. So, I mean, she doesn't break lines as much with blazing speed, but it's Christine Sinclair. She's just so smart. She lives in the pockets of space. She can find them anywhere off the front. When she gets the ball, she rarely uses it. When she gets the ball, she usually makes something happen. And then she gets on the end of crosses, and as we know and as we saw today, if she gets the ball anywhere near the 18-yard box, she's probably going to put it somewhere in the net that the goalkeeper can't get to.
Diana, really good of you to join us today. Thanks so much.
Hey, no problem. Anytime. Nice to talk to you.
Take care. It's Diana Matheson, two times bronze medalist with the Canadian women's team. She is part of CBC's Olympics coverage. Canada with a 1-1 draw this morning against Japan. And Japan, I believe, ranked 11th in the world compared to Canada's ninth place ranking. And you know, Diana's right in that the Canadians did have the majority of the play, but there has to be a little more. There has to be a little more. A little more cutting edge around the box. Like they can't always look for Christine.
The virtue of selfishness. You know, you need somebody. Sometimes just take the shot. You know, take the shot. Don't look for the pass. Be direct. Use the opportunity, and you know, even if it's not 100% opportunity, especially again against. I thought Japan looked not very good.
Yeah.
And you know, like I know that's where they are in the rankings, but Canada looked like a far better side.
Well, and I thought Canada
up and down than Japan did.
Yeah, and I thought, you know, the good news is some of the substitutions Canada made really did seem to have the. I mean, it seemed to have the effect of stretching out the Japanese defensively, which is exactly what you wanted. Again, it was just the opportunities were not taken. Dan's right. Diana's right. It's a tournament, and you know, every tournament kind of develops its own pace. And clearly, the fact that the Americans lost to Sweden will be something that will be much discussed, because the Americans are really fancied going into this. Although, again, the Swedes have also played the Americans tough. It was interesting. I listened to Ali Krieger of the U.S. team was on an ESPN podcast, and they were talking about the teams in the tournament to watch. And she talked about Canada as being one of the teams she really had her eye on. And part of the reason, she said, is that they're not just simply a one-player team anymore. She said there's a lot of pace, and there are some players that she thinks are, she said, just on the verge of really going to the next level. So, it's by no means, as I said, it would have been nice to have the 3 points, but they'll have another chance here. They'll have another chance here.
Well, and Jeff, I think part of this tournament, you know, every tournament has its own dynamic and its own story, whether we're talking about the men's or the women's World Cups or these Olympic tournaments. They always have kind of an internal dynamic that goes beyond the ratings of the teams or even the talent levels. They tell their own story. But yep. I think this one, and again, I'm not saying this is what happened to the Americans today, but it's going to be in part about how these athletes manage these bizarro circumstances, right? This is not comfortable. It's not going to be comfortable. It's going to be weird. Even if you're going to your second or third Olympic games, like Christine Sinclair going to her, you know, what, third or fourth Olympic games, this is not like anything else that any of them have experienced, and it's going to be about who manages that, you know, in part about who manages that the best.
Yes, the difference of it, the oddness of the whole thing will be something that needs to be managed. The expansion draft will go tonight, the Seattle Kraken. Everybody seems to know who they've picked already. Lots of leaks. This much we know, it appears, as if based on the leaks, that Carey Price will not be going to the Kraken. So, will there be a sigh of relief, or has there been a sigh of relief breathed in Montreal, or did most people in Montreal think it wasn't going to happen anyhow? Ren Lavoir, NHL insider, joins us next. This is Writer's Block.
When you choose to work with a deadline for your entire working life, you got to be a little bit crazy. And crazy is great radio. This is Writer's Block with Jeff Blair and Stephen Brunt on Sportsnet 590 The Fan.
All right, so the Seattle Kraken will unveil their inaugural roster tonight on Sportsnet. Much of the heavy lifting, and that was kind of a pun thinking of the dude catching the fish, but much of the heavy lifting seems to already have been done, at least according to social media. We have a good sense, in particular, of who isn't being picked by the Seattle Kraken. We're led to believe, a variety of sources, that the Leafs will lose Jared McCann to the Kraken. Won't be Travis Dermott. Won't be Alex Kerfoot. We're led to believe that Carey Price will not be going to the Kraken. So I guess the question is, for the Montreal Canadiens, does this mean that Marc Bergevin's gamble has paid off, leaving Carey Price unprotected. Or perhaps was it less than a gamble than we think? Let's bring in Ren Lavoie, our NHL insider with TVS Sports. He is in Seattle. And Ren, I'm led to believe that it's cloudy in Seattle. Is this true?
It is. And I guess it's cloudy a little bit for the, I don't know if there's any, but for the Kraken fans, yeesh, what a disaster.
Okay.
I don't know.
Explain that to me.
Well, that's, you know, there's a lot of people that are in shock right now, but one of my good friend who's in the know said to me something really interesting. He said, Renaud, the players that are picked today by the Kraken, some of them, we just don't know about them at all. But he said there's one thing that they have in common, and they're analytics darlings. And I was laughing about it, but it's true. If you look at the analytics numbers, and I mean, it's driven by that expansion draft is driven by numbers and is driven by analytics. And that's why we're looking at the Kraken right now and we're wondering what they're doing, but it's exactly that. So I do believe they're going to have a great American Hockey League team, but I don't understand why they're taking that road, because and I know Gary Bettman or Bill Daly are never going to comment about what the Kraken decided to do today, but that's not the reason why they paid $650 million and have, you know, so many really good players available at the expansion draft. That's the league didn't decide to put all these players available to see what happened today. That's my belief.
What do you think we're going to learn in the next 24 hours about, you know, in terms of deals that were made to not take players, you know, some of the other things that will add up to whatever they actually, you know, the sum total of what they get out of this expansion draft is not just going to be the names. It's going to be some other stuff as well. When do you think we're going to know that?
That's a great question, actually. You know, I don't think that we're looking at the list right now. There is some players that I question if they're really picked by the Kraken. One name is Yanni Gourde. I believe that Yanni Gourde is picked by the Kraken. But if you talk to Yanni Gourde or whoever's around him, they're not aware of that. So it's a little weird. Normally you should be aware of what's your situation, especially right now. So there's a question mark right there. And what's next with the Tampa Bay Lightning? Because I believe that it's not the end of the story between the Lightning and the Kraken. So there's maybe deals in place that we don't know right now, possibly. So we'll learn more for sure. But I don't believe that we'll see, you know, tons of side deals, if any, maybe one or two. But I don't believe it's going to be, you know, that important. If you look at what the Kraken, the road that they decided to take today, it's a simple road. They want to build with prospects, with players that they think that is going to help in the long run, but they're not going to go to the Stanley Cup final next season like the Golden Knights did. We didn't know. Obviously, it's easy to say today that the Golden Knights, after their expansion draft, will be a Stanley Cup contender right from the get-go. But there's a difference, really, between the two expansion draft. I mean, it's not even close if you look at the number of players, talented players with experience that were picked then compared to today.
You know what I find really interesting about this too, Ren? The flip side of this is there are going to be some teams that are going to be going, oh God, we didn't see that coming, right?
Yeah, for sure.
There are going to be some teams that are now going to have guys on big contracts that they thought might go, and oh, by the way, you thought so little of them, you left them unprotected. Like there are going to be some general managers that are going to be sweating this out, aren't there?
Yeah, a little bit. Some of them probably are happy today. I'll say the majority probably are really happy about the situation. They thought that they'll lose a really good player, and not you know, it's not the case for the majority of them. And I think that, you know, if you look at Toronto, what they did was really smart. McCann is a good centerman. I know they really liked him in Pittsburgh, but, you know, they made sure that, you know, the Kraken will pick him, and they won't lose any of the actual players that they had during last season. So that's really good. You know, if you look at the Montreal Canadiens, I think they were a little surprised by Jerry Johansson, the agent of Carey Price, calling on Friday with that idea to expose Carey Price. I mean, it's especially here in Seattle. If it would have been, let's say, in Columbus, I don't think that Carey Price would have even think about waiving his no movement clause. But I guess he said, well, the worst thing that can happen is I'm going to play hockey in Seattle. So, and what's really strange, and you know, you've been in pro sports for how many years, or around pro sports for how many years? You know Seattle as a city. It's the Seahawks. It's the Marlins. The MLS soccer team is one of the best. Mm-hmm. People are excited about the MLS here.
Big so university you, town too. Big university yeah. football team.
Totally. So you're saying to yourself, okay, now they have the chance to go and find a franchise player like Carey Price, and you know, some really good forwards available for them that's going to score goals for them, and really good defensemen. Probably Mark Giordano is the only big name out there right now. And you're looking at the you know, the plan right now. Who are they going to put on their posters? I mean, how are they going to sell the game? They need to. Yeah. Hopefully they have some side deals, some UFAs that they're going to sign next year coming here next week. Sorry, coming here, and maybe you know, we'll understand a little bit more what's happening really. But it's going to be really tough to put one guy on their poster right now after this expansion draft.
Ren, Lord knows when we'll hear from Carey Price, or if we'll hear from Carey Price, or if he'll ever talk about this. So I'm going to, since we don't know, I'm going to have you answer the question. What do you think, you know, if you kind of think about his conversation with his agent, and again, their offer to waive the no movement clause, and then all of these days of speculation, and then finally, obviously, the answer, you know, whenever he knew it, that he wasn't going anywhere. But what do you think's been going through his head the last few days?
Probably, I think that the bottom line is probably they had a good idea that it wouldn't be picked up. But there's a difference between what hockey ops thinks and what ownership thinks, right? And even if people are saying that there's a real gap between, you know, hockey ops in Seattle can do whatever they want, and you know, ownership is not going to have a word to say. Have you ever seen a company working like that, or a pro sports team working like that? No, it's impossible. So that's why it's kind of a surprise to see that, you know, there was not more movement, especially around Carey Price. I think it would have been really easy to pick him up, to sell the game here in Seattle with him. But they I understand that they had another plan. But the conversation must have been really interesting over the last few days. At one point, you know, I'm pretty sure that Ron Francis needed to convince ownership that, yes, Carey Price is a great name. Yes, we're probably going to sell a lot of jerseys with his name on the back, but that's not the plan. And even if Carey's coming in, the plan is not to have a great team from the get-go. So how Carey is going to react to that, and is it going to be good for the franchise in the long run to have Carey Price here? You understand with what we're seeing today that probably that was not a smart move to pick up Carey Price. But I understand at the same time that Carey Price, I'm pretty sure, was looking at the situation. And, you know, Carey is a really good person. He's not the type of guy who's going to sweat about these type of things, but we're talking still about his future in the NHL. Like I mentioned, he knows this area pretty well. His wife's from this area here in Seattle. He played for Tri-City team. That's 2 hours and a half from away from Seattle. So he really knows the area. He's spending actually a summer in Washington State. That's where he's training with his junior team at Tri-City. So, I mean, it would have been a natural in a way for him to play here. But to leave the Montreal Canadiens, you know, it would have been, I'm pretty sure, shocking at the same time. I don't think it would have been necessarily a really super happy day for him if he would have been picked up.
Ren, I'm wondering if the fact that, you know, the Seattle Kraken sold out their season's tickets. When was that? They announced on January 13th that they've sold out their season's tickets. In some ways, doesn't that free up Ron Francis's hands a little bit to go down the analytical route? Because unlike, I mean, it's weird because you made the point. Seattle is a great sports city. But I'm wondering if maybe in some ways, you know, when the NHL went to Vegas, no one was really sure how Vegas was going to react to the NHL, right? And Seattle, I mean, everybody, as you said, it's a great sports city. Does that in some ways maybe play into their hands here?
Totally. Totally. And probably that made the difference. But at the same time, I mean, their reaction to this draft it's a little bit like, okay, well, we're gonna put ourselves like we were the Minnesota Wild or the Blue Jackets or the Ottawa Senators back in the days. We don't have much to pick. We're gonna try to find the best players available, but those guys are not really known around the league or especially with fans. So that's where I have a concern, to be honest. Even if you sold out all your tickets, probably for a few years, it could go down quickly. Look at the Mariners right now; they're struggling here in Seattle. And like I mentioned, the MLS is working really well. What's going to happen with the NBA? Are they coming back here? That's another question. So, I mean, there's a lot of question marks. Obviously, I'm not going to say that I'm a Seattle specialist because I arrived yesterday here. But I like hockey. I like baseball. I like football. I like basketball. I mean, it's really tough to understand why they took that road. But the building is sold out.
But, you know, the other part of that, Ren, is, you know, you look at what Vegas did. There's no counter argument to what they did. Like, they took a different path. They were in the Stanley Cup final immediately. They have built what looks like a sustainable contender. It's not like they sold out for, you know, so I'm not sure there's a counter argument to what they did. Like, it worked. It worked really well.
It worked. And you know what? For me, the Golden Knights right now are there. One player or two away of winning that Stanley Cup, probably one really good centerman or two away from winning that Stanley Cup. This is a really, really good team. Are they as good as the Lightning? I don't know, but you know they're not far away from that. And the reason why they're not far away from that, it's because they had a plan. Yes, the plan changed during the first season. They didn't expect to be that good. But they look at the players that they took. The Jonathan Marchessault of this world, Marc-Andre Fleury, and there's Riley Smith and all these guys. They were kind of rejected by their own team. They were character guy. They had a lot to prove. They wanted to prove that, you know, the teams that let them go did a really big mistake. And I think that was the way that team was built. Seattle, they must probably look around and probably those kids are saying to themselves, well, we have a good chance to make the team this year. Yes, probably, but you're not gonna play in the Stanley Cup final next season, I'm telling you.
Is there a free agent that they may take a run after now?
Probably. Doggy Hamilton, I know they tried, but... You know, there's an advantage to play here in Seattle because in Washington, there's no state tax. Mm-hmm. That's really important, right? A little bit like Vegas or, Arizona, Texas, Florida. Yeah, Texas, exactly. So there's an advantage to play here. And I guess that there's some players that are going to be really, really thinking about playing here. There's a lot of money available now, right? So that's why we need to look at the UFA market. But I believe that they're going to make a push to get some really good players available. There are a lot of good players available, by the way. But what's going to happen with Marc-Andre Fleury in Vegas is another question. So there's a lot of good players, even if not on the UFA market, on the trade market. That's probably they're going to look at it and say, "Hey, this is a nice area. Why not? Let's try this."
Once we get past this expansion draft and the draft, Ren, what do you think the UFA market is going to feel like this year? You know, given the years of flat cap ahead of us.
Yeah, well, that's the story here. Something that's not really out there in the media yet, but teams, or especially I should say, UFA players are not going to sign long term contracts. That's not what some of them. Yes, obviously, but majority of them, I think, are only going to sign 3 or 4 year deals. Why? Because there's a belief right now that the cap will jump in 4 years. If they're hopeful in 3 years, it's going to happen probably in 4 years. But the cap could go from 82 or 83 million to 95, 96, 97 million, like a huge jump, a 10 to 15 million jump from where we are right now. That's a lot of money, and that's why a lot of agents right now are looking at the UFA market and saying to themselves, "Don't," or RFA market, "you don't sign a long-term deal because there'll be a lot of money available for the players in 4 years." So that's something that we're going to see. Don't be surprised if the deals are really, really short next week. There's a reason why, and that's because there's a lot of people in the know thinking that the cap is going to jump, and I've heard close to $100 million in 4 years. I don't believe it, but we'll see. We'll see how it's going to turn out.
Ren, really good of you to do this as always. Thanks so much. Enjoy Seattle, and stay safe and travel safely, my friend.
Thank you very much, and enjoy the rest of the week. Thanks
Take
for
care.
Having me.
Ren Lavoie, our NHL insider with TVS Sports. Very interesting, Stephen, hearing the Kraken using an analytical bent here. And I do think that it is a reflection. And we'll have David Sampson on in a few minutes, and I'll look forward to his thoughts on this. I do think it's a reflection of that market in some ways, that you can be maybe a little more, right now at least, you can be a little more, have a little more of an analytical bent than Vegas did. Although, you know, my goodness, Vegas was successful. This is, this is the thing in comparing the two expansion teams. The caveat is, yeah, I guess you could go a different way philosophically, but Jesus, that team almost won the Stanley Cup.
Why?
You know, why would you do it? Like,
why?
What's wrong with this
blueprint?
Right? What's wrong with this blueprint?
Yeah, it's pretty good. That's what I was kind of, I know they've sold other tickets and maybe they didn't have to go out and, sign names for the sake of names and all of that. Draft names for the sake of names. I get that from a marketing point of view. They don't need to market. But from a hockey point of view, how can you argue with anything Vegas did?
Yeah.
Like, you can't. It's the most successful expansion franchise in any sport ever. Ever. I would copy everything they did, to the letter. It worked. It was brilliant.
Yeah, that is true. Well, we're smarter than them. Well, what? You're going to win the cup your first year? Like, how exactly is this going to work? Anyhow, we'll know more tonight when we see the composition of the roster, the final composition of the roster. And yes, of course, there is a chance that the Kraken may get involved in the UFA market, but if you're a Kraken fan right now and you're looking to slap a name and number in the back of the jersey, I don't know if you've got that name or number yet, Brent. You may be forced to go with your own name on the back of the jersey right now, or just leave it blank.
Or they're going to sell a whole lot of Mark Giordano's. Like, that's,
that could be.
That may be how it goes.
That could be. David Sampson is host of Nothing Personal, the podcast on CBS Sports HQ. He'll join us next. This is Writer's Block. We'll be right back. idea formally of what the Seattle Kraken look like tonight after the NHL expansion draft, or the unveiling, I guess would be the way to put it, more than expansion draft, the unveiling of the Seattle Kraken's roster, because it seems as if everybody in the planet has had an access to one leak or another today and put the roster out there. But it's interesting. We had Ren Lavoie from TVA Sports on just a few minutes ago, and Ren was talking about the approach the Kraken were taking. And it is a very analytical approach. They're not worried about names. They've put on a bunch of guys that, you know, certainly compared to the way the Vegas Golden Knights went about putting together their franchises it just seems to be completely different. Brent and I were joking. If you were going to buy a Kraken jersey today, you'd have a hard time figuring out whose name to put in the back. Mark Giordano, maybe, but you don't know. He could end up with the New York Rangers before the night is over. David Sampson is host of Nothing Personal, the podcast at CBS Sports HQ, and he joins us on Writer's Block. David, I got a lot to talk to you about baseball related, but first, I just wanted to ask you, as someone who's run a team, now we have the Seattle Kraken. All the tickets are sold out. Season's tickets are sold out, I should say. Unlike when the NHL went into Vegas, we kind of have an idea of what Seattle is like as a sports franchise. So I guess in some ways, you know, they probably feel free to go ahead and do this analytical thing to try to build a team. But as my friend Brent points out, you know, Vegas was a different situation, but they put together a team that almost won a Stanley Cup. Like, wouldn't you kind of, you know, analytics are nice, numbers are nice, but if you've got a blueprint that works and you've already sold your tickets, why wouldn't you go ahead and follow the blueprint that works or has worked?
Well, how do you know they're not?
Well, The names certainly suggest they're not taking the same approach.
So I guess my view is that the whole point of analytics is that there are no names. It's completely robotic. It is about who will perform and how the pieces of the puzzle are put together to maximize the goals for and minimize the goals against. And when you're wondering what name should be on the back of the jersey, the whole point of an expansion franchise is the name on the front of the jersey. And that's what they're going to sell, are Kraken jerseys. And then they want to sell Kraken playoff jerseys, and then they want to hoist the cup. Well, I think what they're doing makes a whole lot of sense to me. They don't need a star. They need wins.
Yeah, that's, well, the other guys got, you know, the other guys did win almost immediately, doing it, you know, in Vegas, doing it differently. I guess, you know, look, and again, it may well pan out. I understand what you're saying. Their tickets are all sold there as well, right? They don't have to sell stuff. But I was, you know, the one thing that occurred to me, Dave, is if I was the owner and I just paid $500 million plus for a hockey team, and yeah, I got all my tickets sold and everything, but that Carey Price is being dangled out there, for instance. And, you know, there's some asterisks attached. You don't know what his health is like right now. He's a big ticket guy. He might cause you some cap issues down the road, but he's from the region. He played junior hockey in the state. His wife's from Washington. He waived the no movement clause, so he was willing to go and play there happily, or, you know, at least willing to go and play there. As an owner, wouldn't you be, you know, really tempted to go to your hockey people and say, you know, there's the face of our franchise right there. Plus, he's still pretty good. I think you should take him.
So that is what most owners do, and most owners are meddling and not great. Maybe this owner is letting his hockey people actually do their jobs and saying, I put in $500 million, but I want to have people in charge who this is what they do for a living. One of the big struggles that you have in baseball is when owners come in and think that they know how to be baseball executives. There is no way that this owner knows how to be a hockey executive because he's not one. And it used to be that you bring it.
Well, whether it's Seattle or Vegas, I know what that sound is, Brent.
Yes, we're used to that sound now, aren't we?
That is the sound of a line being dropped, but we will get David back and let him continue to to expand on that. And it is, you know, it is, I will say this too. I mean, this Kraken ownership is not, you know, they're not dilettantes. You know, Tim Lewicki's there. He's part of the group. And my friend Mitch Garber's part of the group. And he certainly understands numbers as well as anybody. So it's understandable. Now we have David Sampson. David, please continue your thoughts. I apologize for the line being dropped.
Yeah, nope, sorry. I did not move. Just mea culpa. I literally did not move, and I have full service where I am. Yeah. Good Wi-Fi even, and I paid my bill. So I would say that when you want a name, right, and you want to use that as a way to market your team, and you think that that's the way to do it, and if that name is from your hometown, let's say a local Floridian or a local Canadian, I learned very quickly that actually your home crowd doesn't care about that. Because if you bring in someone local who doesn't help you win, it doesn't sell tickets. It doesn't do anything long term. And maybe this owner is just learning faster than other owners. So I'm going to give them the benefit of the doubt and say there's a chance they're doing it right.
David, what can sell tickets other than wins? Can anything sell tickets other than wins?
So we told our salespeople every year for 18 years, do not sell wins and losses because you can't control it. Sell experience. Sell bringing your family and having an entertainment option and a memory, making memories. We want it to be like Disney, right? We're in the memory-making business. That's what I always told the salespeople. Don't let me hear you get excited when we're on a 10-game winning streak. But deep down in meetings that I would have with the GM or with the owner, the bottom or with the CFO or with the league, the bottom line is winning is what sells. And I hate to admit that because it's so hard to control. And sometimes you care about it more than the players do. And sometimes you try hard and you can't win, even though you think you're going to win. Sometimes you plan on winning, but then don't, or you don't plan on winning and then you do win a little. But winning is the number one most important thing. And people talk about chemistry. If you can't win, if you don't have good chemistry, to me, that's horse hockey. You can absolutely win with bad chemistry. I've seen plenty of teams that had winning teams where the players couldn't stand each other. You just want to win games.
What do you think? What do you think the runway is now in terms of, you know, if you're starting an expansion team, especially a new sport coming to town? So, oh wow, we've got an NHL team, and there's, you know, you can sell the sizzle and the experience and the novelty and all of that stuff. You know, the experiential stuff of being in the building. At what point does that kind of collide though with the necessity to deliver, you know, on the ice or on the field? I'm sense it's shorter than it once was. You know, that you maybe had a little more wiggle room as the new guys in town than you do now.
So the owner's handbook is 3 to 5 years. That is what you heard Steve Cohen say when he bought the Mets. He said we're going to win a World Series the next 3 to 5 years. That's about page 4 of the new owner's playbook, where you tell your fan base that we want to win here and our runway is 3 to 5 years. Unfortunately, what happens when you're an expansion team, and it happened with the Marlins, they've always been compared with the Rockies, and then you've got the Diamondbacks and the Rays, and expansion teams are always compared to each other. And I remember how jealous the other expansion teams were when the Marlins kept winning World Series, and they've won 2 of them. And the Knights, having done so well, that certainly creates a sense of urgency. But if you're smart, you don't succumb to that, because when you do, you end up signing names that you just slot together. You ignore the analytics, and then you end up losing and delaying yourself. As a matter of fact, it happened in Tampa right when I got into baseball, or maybe after, before I got in. The Tampa Bay Rays went on a crazy spending spree 1 year. They brought in like Wade Boggs and Jose Canseco and Fred McGriff. I can't remember what year that was. And that was an attempt to sort of jumpstart life in Tampa. And of course it didn't work. And what's ended up working for Tampa is when they didn't care about the names on the back of the jerseys, they would trade players a year too early versus a year too late. They would tell their fans, they're not going to sign these guys long-term. And guess what? They're, to me, one of the top 3 successful franchises in all of baseball.
So David, explain to me in your mind where Major League Baseball is right now in terms of getting that new ballpark built in Oakland, because you know, the city of Oakland approved something. It didn't appear necessarily to approve the thing that Major League Baseball or the A's ownership thought they were voting on. Look, I mean, these things, I understand these things, there's a lot of stages here, but where do you think this thing sits right now?
So I did a segment on this on Today's Nothing Personal, actually, Jeff, and I wanted to explain to your audience that what passed yesterday was a non-binding agreement,
right?
Which means it has all the weight of a feather. And there is absolutely no guarantee that the city in Oakland is going to go forward. There's no guarantee that the team is going to go forward. There's no obligation for either side to go forward, which is why you had the president of the A's pulling a Samson trick and doing a press availability in Vegas today and saying, I'm here because I need to be on dual paths. Mm-hmm. I mean, that is obviously page one of the threatening leverage playbook. And you had the politicians in Oakland saying, hey, we've made a lot of effort here. We've covered a lot of ground. We've given in on a lot of items. We really hope they accept this deal. But what's really going on behind the scenes is more negotiating, where the A's are saying to the politicians, here's the following 10 issues that are left, and you're going to need to give because we've got a Vegas deal here that's ready to go. But baseball does not want Oakland to move to Vegas. They want Vegas to be available as an expansion because – I'll tell you that John Fisher is not going to write a billion-dollar check to relocate to Vegas. It's not going to happen. And $1 billion is what's going to be paid by a new owner to come in and get the Vegas territory. And you can only use Vegas once. But it's being used right now, in my mind, as leverage. And the work that's being done by the A's in terms of a new ballpark is helpful because that can be used when it comes time for expansion.
So I understand, like, that again, one of the great principles of, you know, sport is that, you know, the sports business is you don't want to give up expansion, lucrative expansion sites for relocation, because there's a lot more money in expansion and everybody gets to share in it. But the flip side of that, David, is how much does baseball want Oakland to stay in Oakland for, you know, like, is if the market were not Vegas, which would appear to be a very lucrative spot to go, if there was another kind of secondary market that would accept relocate, that where they could relocate this team, would baseball prefer that to get out of the morass that has been Oakland all these years?
No, because from baseball's standpoint, remember, Oakland has had a very interesting situation as it relates to revenue sharing. They have not been huge revenue sharing recipients the way the Marlins are, or the Rays, or the Indians, or the Royals. And so having a new ballpark for the A's is important because the Alameda Coliseum, which has a new name every other week, so I don't know what it's called right now, but that ballpark is just not pleasant for the players, and the union doesn't want to play in that ballpark, and neither does MLB, frankly. Nobody wants to be there. But they would much rather have a team in Oakland from a location standpoint, because if you relocate Oakland, you have to relocate it west. And a lot of the great relocation cities are east, actually. But because of the way the league is and because of the way the divisions are, you have to keep Oakland west. Now, once Major League Baseball goes to 32, you're going to add an east, you're going to add another west, and you're going to maybe realign and do a huge realignment, which we started discussing many, many years ago. Mm. But boy, that's a long way of saying they'd much prefer a deal done in Oakland so they can move on to the Tampa issue, get that done, and then move on to the expansion issue.
That's a fascinating bit of information, because I hadn't thought of the fact that one of the benefits, if you want to call it that, of Oakland doing what they do is they don't need revenue sharing money to pull it off, do they? Because they're not going to be spending $280 million on player payroll.
There's no doubt. It's another market that even in a new ballpark, their payroll is not going to be crazed. It's not going to go very high, and it's not going to do anything to put the salaries out of whack. And that's something the commissioner's office thinks about, no doubt about it.
David, when you were in a decision-making position with the Marlins and you guys were contending and you were looking at the trade deadline and you had to decide between a player with a little bit of control and a guy who was going to be a rental, how would you have gone about balancing that out? Like, let's assume that there's not a tremendous, you know, I'm not talking about a guy who's under control because he's not very good and he's going to give you 3 years of mediocre pitching, and another guy who's Cy Young caliber pitcher who's going to go on become a free agent. But all things being equal, how would you view control versus anything else when it came to making that decision to trade for a guy?
You're talking to the guy who traded Chris Paddock to the Padres for Francisco Rodney, who never got a guy out once he came to us. And I had a view that was very different than many, if not all, of our baseball people, that was more in line with our owner and what Jeffrey thought. I never wanted to do a press release ever to celebrate how good our minor league system was. I never wanted to do a press release to say we are the number three ranked farm system, according to Baseball America, or we have four championships in single A, double A, triple A, 40 games above 500. Don't look at the major league side where we lost 95 games, but boy, look at the minor league side. How good are we? I never wanted to promote that because I always thought that my job was to win at the major league level, period, hard stop. So when we had a chance, and this is where it gets tough, because being delusional hurts. And delusion is when you think you have a chance when you really don't, but you want to go for it on the possibility that you're going to get hot and that the team is going to start playing differently if you add to it and the clubhouse is going to feel good about itself because you brought someone in. But the reality is that you're probably not going to make it, so why waste the minor league capital? I always erred on the side of wasting the minor league capital. We'll fill it up again in the draft, but let's try to see if Rodney can get guys out. Let's try to add another pitcher or another bat like a Carlos Lee. I mean, I could go down the list of pitchers. In 03, we traded for Urbina in June and gave up Adrian Gonzalez.
Yeah.
Now, you may be saying that's insane. And I say we won a World Series. I would have traded Babe Ruth to win a World Series in 03 because they can't take that away from you. Of course, Adrian Gonzalez became one of the great first basemen ever, but I'll take Urbina for 2 months over a career of not winning a World Series with Adrian Gonzalez every day of the week.
Yeah, and the thing about that deal, I remember at the time, like, I'm a big believer. If you think your team is good enough and you can get a big piece in June, never mind the deadline. Just do it. And go ahead and do it and worry about what happens at the deadline. It's just the way I've always felt.
Well, I always wanted to be early. Right now, everyone is so risk-averse because everyone is so afraid to trade away young players. They're so afraid to trade away control. And everything is being done by computer and through analytics, where literally when there is a trade, what the analytics department does is they put a formula into their code. They put all the players in the formula, and if they don't come out ahead, if you will, and control is a part of it and expected performance is a part of it, then you're not making a trade. My view was to talk to our old-time scouts and to our team and to our manager and to our owner and say, listen, we need help right now offensively, or we need help in the back of the bullpen. Let's do it now. We may overpay, but if we don't play well in the next month, we'll move them. And the Marlins continued to play well in 03. And so we kept him, and it ended up working out. Some years it works, some years it doesn't. But to me, I think I should be judged as an 18-year team president by World Series victories. And I went 1-for-18. And that is not a great batting average, but that is my batting average.
Do you think the clubhouse stuff matters at all? Like the idea that it's if you don't, you know, make a move for a team that's on the edge, that's close. There's a kind of a notorious Blue Jays example in 2014 when they were hamstrung, you know, in terms of payroll. They didn't make a move for a team that, you know, probably wasn't going to win but had a chance. And there was a kind of an ugly ripple through the clubhouse about how they weren't supported by ownership. Do you think that can matter?
You mean like what could happen with the Yankees this year? Where they probably won't win,
exactly,
but they could. And they're right up against the luxury tax threshold, so they're not going to add more than $3 million in payroll. I guarantee it. Steinbrenner's not going to go over on a wing and a prayer. It's way too costly to do it. What I did to deal with that, because it is a real thing, is I would be in the clubhouse and talk to the players and say, hey, guys, just so you know, it's just us. We cannot bring in help, and here's why we're not doing it. And I would tell them the truth, or I'd say, hey, if we can win 7 of our next 10 games, we're convincing the owner and he's approved to bring in help and we're not going to take off the major league roster. Or I would say, hey, we're going to move people off the major league roster because we're sellers. I was very open with the players in a way that made all of my GMs and owner very uncomfortable because I wanted them to know where we stood. I didn't think it was a big deal. I didn't think I was hiding the formula for new Coke or anything. I was just talking to the players about the reality of the business side of the game. But I think what players want is communication, and when they don't get communication, they can get a little antsy, shall we say.
David, really good of you to join us today. Thanks so much, as always.
Hey, have a great day. Thank you.
David Sampson, host of Nothing Personal, the podcast at CBS Sports HQ. We will take a break and come back. This is Writer's Block on Sportsnet 590, The Fan. last night, Stephen Brunt of Blue Jays baseball in Buffalo. Then it's off to New York. It's off to Boston. And then it's back here. And we will bid adieu to lovely Salem Field.
Are they seeding the clouds? Like, I haven't looked at the weather forecast in Buffalo yet, but I imagine them seeding the clouds.
Yeah, I imagine. There's just a little plane. There's Ross and Mark. Well, nah, Ross is on Tim and Friends at 5:20, so I just imagine they're there with, like, the stuff that they took to China so that it wouldn't rain, right? You know, during the Olympics, or to get rid of the smog. I just imagine them, like dumping this stuff over there. Oh, my God, there's a leak. The plumbing's leaking. Oh, Jesus, we'll have to cancel a game tonight. God love the, listen, all kidding aside, other than when the Yankees and the Red Sox are there, Buffalo was a fine, fine home for the Blue Jays. They took good care of the boys. They really did. And, but it is time, boy, it's time to come home. And, like I said, it's going to seem like opening day. It's really going to seem, like opening day and trade deadline 2015, combined.
Let the countdown begin.
Absolutely. And again, we will have Blue Jays baseball tonight, 7:07 first pitch. They get Kraken in Seattle tonight as well. Come on. Josh is looking at me. 6-0 has already used it, for God's sake. I mean, it's the only time I'm going to use it, that, you know, get Kraken in Seattle. It'll be Ron Francis. He's the GM of the Seattle Kraken. Ross Atkins, Mike Fuda, and Mark Stein joining Tim and Friends. So there you go. Lots of puck talk ahead. Don't forget, as I said, Blue Jays baseball tonight. Kraken draft. It's going to take a while getting used to seeing Seattle Kraken. Brunt, thanks for doing this. Talk tomorrow.
See you tomorrow.
Have a great night, everybody.